Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just last week, New York became the latest state to legalize gay marriage. And yesterday was the 42nd anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, an event that many see as the beginning of the gay rights movement.
But there's a new book out by Dartmouth professor Michael Bronski that traces the history of gay America back a lot farther than 1969.
And that history has roots a lot closer to home than New York City. Bronski says look no further than Cambridge and names like Michael Wigglesworth.
If you know Harvard Yard, there's a Wigglesworth Hall. It's a freshman dormitory. They named it for students without having read his diaries, apparently.
Those diaries, they date back to 1653.
And it's quite shocking for us even today. He actually confesses his unnatural, filthy lust for his students.
Those words, unnatural, filthy lust, quote unquote, those are Wigglesworth's own words
that he had written in his diary.
Yes.
It's one of the first records we have of same-sex desire, even if he doesn't approve of it himself.
Hold on, Meghna. I mean, this isn't like the first, as in the first historical record of same-sex desire, is it?
No, you're right. It's not the first in all of recorded time. I mean, I guess I should have mentioned this earlier. The title of Michael Bronski's book, it's A Queer History of the United States. And actually, the same-sex desire part isn't even really the point that Bronski was making with Wigglesworth. It's the fact that Wigglesworth was writing about desire at all. That was really the issue.
What's really interesting is that if you read some historians, like I'm thinking of Alan Bray, who's a British historian, Alan Bray says, clearly, Wigglesworth does not think highly of his unnatural, filthy lust. But his real shortcoming, the real failing here, is that he's actually transgressing gender roles because he's feeling too much and becoming womanly. You know, because the Puritans are a profoundly theological society. It's not that he's not being butch. It's that he's actually transgressing God's plan for how men are supposed to act.
Or to put it another way?
The sinfulness is not only because he's lusting, but the sinfulness is he's actually feeling.
So Anthony Bronski also tells another story, but this one is about Deborah Sampson, born in 1760, just outside of Plymouth.
So a revolutionary girl.
Right. And Sampson was desperate to be free of the British.
Now she wasn't transgressing for feeling that way, was she?
No. Okay. To use a bit of academic parlance, if I may, that was socially normative at the time. But what was unusual was that she fought in the revolution as a man. In fact, she enlisted as Robert Shurtleff. Deborah, or Robert, fought until she was wounded and the army discovered that she was a woman, and so they kicked her out. She gets married, has kids, but then she wanted to get her military pension.
Which is understandable, because she's a war veteran, right? She deserves a pension.
Exactly, so she petitions for one.
And they said, no, you're a girl. But to further her public relations campaign, essentially, she toured around New England. The first half of her show, her act, was that she talked about how she fought in the revolution. She really doesn't know why, because she was a woman and she loves her children and she loves her husband. But nevertheless, she dressed as a man for 3.5 years. The second act, she'd come out dressed as a man and do like an hour-long, very difficult military drill with arms and exercises and marching back and forth. So, you know, as far back as the late 1780s, we have this notion of America being pretty free with gender roles.
All right, Meghna, so Wigglesworth and Sampson, a.k.a. Lusty and Robert, who else?
Well, here's the thing. There are indeed many names throughout history and many names in this book, but the book is actually much more than an anthology of gay biographies. In fact, Bronski says that queer history as a concept itself has two seemingly paradoxical axioms.
There are two things to keep in mind. The first thing to keep in mind is that LGBT people are integral to every single aspect of American society from before Columbus got here up until the present. And to ignore this is a terrible thing, and we need to bring these people to the forefront. The second most important thing to keep in mind is that queer history doesn't exist. what we're looking at here is American history. And I would argue this is true of African-American history, of women's history, of Latino history. These are absolutely necessary and great transitional moments. And I should add, they may be transitional for 100 years. Mm-hmm. But to not claim it as being American history shortchanges these people, shortchanges the LGBT community, and also shortchanges the imagination of all Americans to accept the fact that we come from, whether we love it or hate it or whatever, a country that is so complex, so ever-evolving, so complicated in its history, this wonderful collection of people, all of whom make up America.
Mm. You know, as I was reading your book, it occurred to me it's very much like wearing a set of polarizing lenses on your sunglasses. You're looking at the same picture, the same image. Everyone is all there, but you just rotate the lenses 90 degrees and suddenly a whole new dimension, you know, that you hadn't seen before, and the way that it's all connected emerges. That's kind of the sense that I got from your book. I want to talk a little bit regarding where we find ourselves today. But in order to do that, I wanted to raise something that you identified in your book, and that is the transcendentalists and sort of the mid-19th century. We have Walt Whitman, you know, writing overtly sexual themes in Leaves of Grass. We also have Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau writing about their quote-unquote sympathies for male friends. Now, you really highlight this word sympathy in particular. Why is that?
It's a word we actually have a very specific meaning for today that actually in the 18th and 19th century was used very differently. And sympathy meant closer to what we now call empathy. When you had sympathy, it meant that you could understand another human. You could understand your fellow man, by which they generally meant man. What's interesting about it then, because there are such huge inequalities between the sexes, it's hard for men and women to have sympathy for one another since they're essentially viewed as different species in some way. So the notion of sympathy works best as a concept between men and between women. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I really chart how we see this affection, affiliation, often in the case of Walt Whitman, certainly overt sexual desire. But we see it in the journals of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who clearly falls in love with a man in his Harvard class named Martin Gay, whom he has sympathy for.
And he writes pretty intensely about his attraction to him.
Yes, as does a passage I quote from Henry David Thoreau, where he's actually hiding in a willow tree watching naked boys bathe. He doesn't use the word sympathy, but he actually is clearly fascinated by them and then has a meditation on white skin, red skin, black skin, and brown skin and how this evolves into a notion of sort of social justice for all men. We also see it in the writings of Margaret Fuller as well. And I would argue that these people are saying, we've come from this Puritan society. We reject this completely. Mm-hmm. We want to fulfill the promise of America. We want to have social justice for everybody. And these people who have this great sympathy, really, they work in the abolition movement. They work in suffrage. They begin working in any number of different reform movements, education. Samuel Grinley Howe starts the Perkins School for the Blind. You know, these people, and this is pretty much a New England, Boston phenomenon,
right,
really start the very notion of what we consider equality within America.
Well, the reason why I ask is there's no evidence to me, at least, you know, in my readings of Emerson and Thoreau, that, you know, they were identifying overtly or consciously with whatever homosexuality meant at that time. No evidence of that
whatsoever.
No evidence
at all. And to be fair, homosexuality, the word is not invented until 1869. So there is no concept of, I'm feeling this, I must be a homosexual.
Well, that's exactly the point, right? Yeah. So it seems that there were many times in American history where there's a greater degree of fluidity, of forgiveness even, or just a wider sense as to the spectrum of human sympathies, right, emotions, desires.
Possibilities.
Then we may even have today. Because any writer today who would put, you know, in modern terms, those same sensibilities and desires would immediately be identified, whether he or she wanted to or not, as someone writing from an LGBT perspective.
Completely. And we see this all the time. We see it certainly when the journals and letters of John Cheever were published. People said, oh my God, John Cheever's a homosexual. And John Cheever was happily, or he was drunk most of the time, but was actually, you know, married, had children, had some affairs with men, which he was tortured over. But certainly, there's no way that John Cheever is a homosexual in the way that we mean that.
Right.
He's a person that had same-sex desires, which he sometimes acted on, felt badly about. But our tendency to label... You know, another reason why I think using the word queer is useful for the book title, because the word queer really seemed to fit into the notion of sort of queering, and not in the more current sense, but in the older sense of making it different,
mm-hmm.
of queering something, of getting what you had said earlier, was that it was sort of like wearing those glasses and you suddenly see, oh, if we tilt it this way, it looks very different now. Not only adding LGBT people, but adding all kinds of new information that would make us rethink
mm-hmm.
the real complexity and the real kaleidoscope that American history has actually been.
Because I guess what I'm wondering is, in the many political advancements and civil rights mm-hmm. advancements that have been made in the past many hundred years mm-hmm. regarding the LGBT community, have we ironically... at the same time reached a point where, because identity is so much part of modern-day queer issues, that it's actually reduced our understanding of the spectrum of possibilities of human desires for everybody else?
Right, completely. And I think this is true of many identities and many movements. Certainly, I teach at Dartmouth College. I have women students who will not ever say that they were feminists. They hate the word feminist. If you give them a checklist of what they believed in, it would be 100% what Gloria Steinem would articulate as feminism.
So we are in a place of more limited imagination today?
I believe so. I believe two things. I believe that we're in a place of limited imaginations, and we're in a place of people having, for very good reasons, constructed a language to identify people, to express who they are. And it's a language that was, over time, very liberatory. And I believe in some ways has become more limiting in how people will describe themselves and how they will actually discuss or think about their own possibilities.
Hmm. Now, I don't want anyone to think that, you know, I'm being a Pollyanna here and saying, oh, it was so great back then
right.
In comparison to now, or that it, you know, now is even perfect in and of itself, because obviously when it comes to LGBT issues and, quite frankly, homophobia of any kind, that it's still a huge problem in American society. And that actually leads me, I mean, since we started talking about queer history in the United States and how it has an early epicenter here in New England, mm-hmm. it also has a very current modern-day epicenter in terms of gay marriage, you know, Massachusetts
Completely.
Being
yes.
the first state
the
that
first
legalized
state, yes.
same-sex marriage. But Michael Bronski, you, interestingly, you say that you're of two minds about gay marriage.
Well, I am. I'm of far more than two minds about it. Without any doubt or hesitation, if we have a system of marriage in America that is a legal contract, gay people, LGBT people, queer people should be included in that, then it's simply equality under the law. If we have marriage, which we do and we will for a very long time, I don't see any way we aren't going to have it, we should have same-sex marriage. It is simply legal equality. You know, I do think there is a way in which marriage historically and traditionally has been a way to organize society. There are ways in which marriage is fully described by its proponents and people who are not in favor of it as being a way to limit the possibilities of human behavior. One of the themes in the book is that I talk about that there's this real tension in American society. And it's a tension that exists for all people and all groups. And the tension is the fight for equality under the law, which is extraordinarily important and really necessary because the law has been so unequally applied for hundreds of years. The other impulse, and I think this is in many ways a very American impulse, is actually one of personal freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So if, in fact, the book has non-queer, or I think they may be queer, non-LGBT heroes, one of them is Victoria Woodhull, who is the first woman to run for president in 1862, who actually announces that she is a free lover and can choose any man she wants for as long as she wants or as short as she wants, and that is her constitutional right of freedom of love and affection. And I think that so many times in the history of the LGBT movement, lesbians and gay men, particularly looking at the 50s, have simply fought to keep the state out of their bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now marriage actually puts the state into your bedroom. And that's fine. That's equality under the law. But I just want to for us to have a discussion that there is actually a tension here between these two different impulses. And if people want to get married, they certainly shouldn't. That would be wonderful for them. And if people don't want to, they should not get married and take Victoria Woodhull's advice and take lovers for as short or long a time as they choose. But these are two different, very American struggles.
Well, Michael Bronski, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Michael Bronski's new book is A Queer History of the United States.